Welcome to Notice History, the podcast where we uncover the history all around us. As always, we're your hosts,
Keely McCabot
and Robin Mullins.
I got to go first for the first time ever.
How did it feel?
Pretty great. It's great being on top.
I'm glad that today could be a win for you.
I deserve it.
You've earned it.
I've earned this.
And Nick Bridges, unfortunately, cannot join us because he is on a road trip.
It's actually happening, ladies and gentlemen. It's no longer just in the realm of imaginary podcast land. One of us is actually on a road trip.
And I was recently on a road trip.
Yeah.
To Quebec.
Nice.
I know, it's very timely. Yeah. It's almost like I did it on purpose as research for this episode.
Always a researcher.
Always. I'm very dedicated to the cause. I may be on maternity leave, but I never sleep. Truly. And I also never give up on this podcast. So on the topic of road trips, so far we've talked about our favorite road trip songs for our playlist, a very important essential. Mm-hmm. We've talked about our snacks, our favorite type of transportation for a road trip. Mm-hmm. I still remember your aqua bus.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
I'm sticking by that.
I know.
It's a quality selection.
Sure. So I think the final and important question is, what is your favorite road trip movie?
Well, I was going to steal the one Nick told me he would say.
Oh, well, we still need to cover the one he was going to say.
Okay, so Nick said that he would pick Fury Road, like Mad Max Fury Road. That's a great choice, and I was really annoyed that he thought of it before I did.
Is it a great choice, or is it, like, a very ill-fated choice?
Well, it's ill-fated, but it's a good movie. What about you? Because I honestly can't really think of a road trip movie. I've been, like...
It doesn't have to be about... I mean, it could be something that you could watch in the back. Like, you know, those trips when you were, you know, perhaps in grade 8 for a grade 8 graduation trip to, say, Montreal. And they played those really, really nerdy movies or, you know, just weird... Like, Twister. Twister was always a movie.
Right.
That thing you do. Ours, for some reason, was Along Came a Spider.
Oh.
Yeah. Real unsettling. Real unsettling. However, my road trip movie would be the obvious choice. More obvious, I think, than Fury Road. Crossroads. The Britney Spears road trip movie.
I recall the poster for that.
Yeah.
The cobwebs of my mind.
Yeah.
I can see
it. It's not a good movie, but it's a movie. And
that's
good. And it's about a road trip.
Well, these are the things I'm thinking of, and then I will cede to yours.
Okay.
So I was thinking, Lord of the Rings technically could be like a road
trip. That's a total road
trip. Because
it's on foot.
You're on a horse sometimes. Sometimes you're walking.
Oh, no, that's
sometimes you're running, you know.
That's a quest movie version. Quests count as road trips.
Okay, then yes. I would pick that one.
Great. Okay, so the other one that I was thinking of, honorable mention goes out to Spice World.
Oh, it is.
Because they're in the, like, tour bus.
Yes, it counts.
And they're driving around London on an adventure. And I mean... I've never understood what's going on to make that tour bus so huge that it has two floors in it. And, like, the interior does not match the exterior. It's a real Harry Potter situation.
Yeah. And if you are too young or just an unfortunate soul who did not watch Spice World, look it up. Because it's a treasure.
But it does not hold up well over time.
No, but that's half of the treasure.
Yeah, fair enough. Well, if it's not already obvious, we love summer and all things that go along with summer. It's a time for picnics, sitting on the dock of the bay, and of course, our favorite, the road trip. This summer, we've been traveling on a cross-country virtual road trip exploring some of Canada's regional history. In our previous episodes, we've touched on locations in eastern Canada, up north into the territories, and then across western Canada. Today, we'll be making the final stops on our adventure. It's time to come to an end.
Just like the third Lord of the Rings movie.
Exactly, yes.
Well, you all got to tie it up. It's got to wrap everything up.
So now it's time to buckle up, grab your favorite snacks, and don't forget the bug spray. It's important because today our virtual road trip is heading to Central Canada. So you may notice that as we go on our road trip through Ontario and Quebec that there will be kind of a theme emerging as to the types of places that we're going to be exploring. That's because Ontario and Quebec hold some of the oldest settlement sites in Canada. If you're taking a long drive through Upper and Lower Canada, or just planning a trip to these historic provinces, we've got a few sites that we think might be worth stopping at. They're a great chance to hear the stories of those that lived in these areas and have some fun on your vacation at the same time.
History is fun. You heard it here first. The first stop on our trip is Fort Henry in Kingston. Built on Point Henry in Kingston, this former British fort serves as a remarkable window into several eras of Canada's past. The first fortification of Point Henry was built by the British during the War of 1812 in order to defend the naval base at Point Frederick. After the war, the fort was maintained as a precaution until it was replaced by a larger fortification, Fort Henry. The construction took 5 years, from 1832 to 1837. Now the fort was to defend not only naval operations at Point Frederick, but the town of Kingston and the entrance to the newly built Rideau Canal that served as a transportation artery between Montreal and Ottawa to the east and all locations that were west of Kingston.
Fun fact, the fort is actually smaller than the original plans called for. The construction was scaled back after the Rideau Canal went over budget, something that continues to this day, going over budget. So in 1870, the British left the fort when they were recalled to Britain. It was in turn garrisoned by Canadian forces until 1891, and then it was abandoned. During the First World War, the fort was suddenly brought back into service by the military, but not as a defensive structure. Instead, it was turned into an internment camp, and the fort received superficial repairs and was then used to hold political prisoners. This lasted until November 1917, and then the fort was ignored for another 2 decades.
However, in 1936, a joint federal and provincial project began to restore the fort. The goal was to open it as a museum and a historic site. In 1938, the work was completed and Prime Minister William Lyon Mackenzie King inaugurated it, in his words, quote, "in the name of all British soldiers who served here," end quote.
Ronald L. Way, a historian, oversaw the restoration and saw that the historic nature of the fort was preserved and represented. He was also known for restoring several other forts in Ontario, and he was the director of Fort Henry itself from the 1938 opening until 1970, which is a very long time.
Like, he's committed.
He was really committed.
When the Second World War began, Fort Henry temporarily ceased to be a museum, and it once again became an internment camp. This time for enemy merchant seamen, soldiers, sailors, and airmen. It was called Camp 31. Fort Henry would not reopen as a historic site again until 1948. It has remained a museum and a historic site to this day. I think that's very interesting and kind of unusual, you know, to have a historical site that is set up as a museum and then to have it brought back into active service. I think that's pretty interesting.
Today, Fort Henry offers visitors a look at life in the fort, circa 1867. Actors take on the civilian roles at the fort, from school teachers to servants, while others take on the role of British soldiers. Tours are provided as well as military demonstrations, performances, and more, and a significant effort is made to bring history to life, specifically from this 1 year.
Recently, in the fall, the fort closes, and it reopens in October as Fort Fright, a month-long event that transforms the fort into a haunted house-style site complete with actors. The event has been successful so far, but it can be controversial in heritage circles. Is closing the fort and removing the historic and educational elements worth the extra income and interest that Fort Fright draws? We've talked about this on a previous podcast, so we've covered this ground, but it is still fertile and interesting.
It is, and we'll make sure that we have a reference to those episodes in the show notes, because we have touched on this before, but it still remains, you know, it's like you said, there's so much here to discuss. I know that it's controversial to be using sites in this way, but there are so many different sites, many of which are in Ontario, that are needing to do this. And the Diefen Bunker has escape rooms, but Upper Canada Village is home to all kinds of different things. They have a light festival throughout the winter holidays, and my favorite event, which I still have not attended, but maybe now that I have a child, I'll be able to go to Pumpkinferno.
I would love to go to Pumpkinferno.
I really want to go.
It's been 2 years of like anticipation.
I know. But, you know, more and more places are having to turn to this for additional sources of revenue. And if it's getting people in and helping them to experience these spaces that they may otherwise not choose to attend, I think that's still a win.
Yeah. And I think to make an argument that
the events that are happening there aren't representative of the history of the site maybe isn't encompassing enough, because the events happening there have now become the history of that site.
Yeah, and these sites have had all kinds of things. Like, it was an internment camp for Fort Henry. That isn't necessarily in keeping with history, necessarily. It has become part of its history. That is an important piece. And I think it's important to note that that is not one of the time frames that they've chosen to represent. In, you know, they chose 1867, and they could have just as easily chosen it while it was an internment camp during the First World War or the Second World War. But, you know, they're choosing something very specific to represent. And that's just what happens when we have history. You can't, if you want to do something like that, you can't always have people from all these different time zones and eras being represented equally. You know, you kind of have to choose something, and naturally something is going to be left out.
So it's not so much a question of, like, whether or not it's appropriate. I think it's more so a question of, like, you're choosing to cut things out anyway for the just practicality. So what are you choosing to leave out? And you have to leave things out. So I don't know. I don't think that is any more appropriate than having Fort Fright or Pumpkinferno, which I am excited for.
We'll have to do a Notice History Goes to Pumpkinferno event.
And it will just be the audio recording of us going, oh, cool.
It'll just be my child haunting the podcast, much like he is currently doing. I don't know if that's being picked up in the audio, but he's trying to be spooky in the background.
He is very jazzed for Fort Fright.
Oh, yeah. That and Pumpkinferno. Yes. He is on board.
Keeping with our spooky theme, we are now moving to Toronto, to the necropolis, which already sounds incredibly spooky.
It does. It doesn't necessarily sound like the kind of place I'd want to go on my road trip, but, you know, we're trying to throw in something for everyone.
Yep, covering all the bases. And if it sounds spooky, that could be because necropolis means city of the dead in ancient Greek. So if you had those hairs standing up on the back of your neck, that is probably why. Latin.
So this site was a site of the ordinary people for ordinary people. Funds to purchase the land the cemetery was originally on was actually raised by donation, and people from all walks of life are buried there, from the man who discovered that dinosaurs roamed Alberta, to one of the founders of Confederation, to the first taxi driver in Toronto. And it's also still operating, although it must be noted that there is very limited burial space. So if you want in, you gotta get in now. You know what they say about cemeteries, Keely?
What?
People are dying to get in there.
In 2015, there were approximately 62,000 people interred at the necropolis. In 1835, when Toronto was still called York, there were only two burial grounds. They were owned by the Anglican and Roman Catholic denominations. These were the only faiths that were empowered to hold land for burial purposes.
For 24 years, the Potter's Field was the only non-sectarian burying ground, and it was rapidly filled. That's because the Potter's Field was a place for people who couldn't afford a proper burial, such as the poor or maybe the unknown or unclaimed bodies. So it really was able to be filled up pretty quickly. So that's why the necropolis opened. It was due to a need for more burial space. The Church of England cemetery was strictly sectarian, and the Potter's Fields were already overcrowded. So there was a need for, quote, a solemn place where thoughtless, restless men may pause and feel.
A group of inhabitants of York petitioned the Upper Canada Legislature to be allowed to open a non-denominational cemetery. Within a handful of decades, the cemetery grew rapidly. Luckily, there was plenty of land around the cemetery for expansion. Established by Presbyterian businessmen in 1850, the necropolis opened when the first non-sectarian cemetery, the Potter's Fields, closed. The remains at the Potter's Fields were reinterred at the necropolis. The necropolis was open to all sects, any denomination, for any type of service. Although it may be unconventional, the necropolis is a very important stop on our road trip.
So the next place on our stop is way over to the west. Very much out of the way on our drive, but we're going to make a stop there because it's important.
It's important.
It's an important place. We're going to Nays Provincial Park.
Today, Nays Provincial Park is a beautiful campground, very typical of the many that can be found around the province. Resting on the shores of Lake Superior, Nays claims to have one of the finest sand beaches on Lake Superior, as well as wildlife aplenty.
And also someone amazing on their media team, because we did a quick Google on Nays Provincial Park, and we found a YouTube video that we're going to put a link up because we watched only the first 10 seconds and boy was it a trip. It started off with like a man in a wig with painting the countryside, mm-hmm. with like a parks ranger approaching him. It had some amazing music. It really looks like they're having a great time there.
And now we are, because we're here. We're in Nez Provincial Park. Although there is a lot of beautiful scenery, what some may not know about this area is that it was used as a prisoner of war camp during the Second World War, and it was also known as Nez Camp 100. During both the First and Second World Wars, over 34,000 German prisoners of war were held in Canadian-operated prison camps. The largest were in Alberta, but Ontario also had 10 of them. The first prisoner of war camps, or POW camps, were created to imprison those of, quote, questionable loyalty living in Canada, who were arrested by the RCMP after war was declared in 1939. This was allowed by the War Measures Act. Anyone who was suspected of having fascist sympathies or spying was arrested, most notably Germans and Italians. In 1940, England asked Canada to accept enemy aliens and POWs from British camps. Nez Camp, specifically, mainly held high-ranking German prisoners of war and operated from 1941 to 1946. This camp was very remote, especially since the highway did not yet exist. The location was chosen mainly for its proximity to a rail line, the CPR. It was easier to get prisoners and supplies in and out. The fact that the camp was surrounded by Lake Superior and a large boreal forest helped because it provided a natural boundary, making escape far more difficult.
The camp comprised of 27 buildings surrounded by a 10-foot-high barbed wire fence and guard towers at each corner. There were 4 barracks, a senior prisoner's barracks, a hospital, a mess hall, a recreation hall, and a detention cell. And the camp had the capacity to hold 500 prisoners and 100 guards.
Following the closure of the camp, the prisoners were sent back to Germany in March of 1946. The infrastructure of the camp was used as a Japanese-Canadian relocation camp for 6 months during 1946 to 1947. It was used as a free place to stay, eat, and find family and friends who had been separated during the war.
At present, much of the infrastructure of this camp is gone, though some remnants can be seen throughout the park. For instance, the foundations of the mess hall are still present. Nez was designated as a provincial park in 1965, and that's when it decided to open its doors to campers. And while Nez Camp 100 is not a typical museum site, you can visit the visitor center of the park to see a model of the camp and a photo book of the site's history.
It's important to note that even though it is now a campground, Nez Provincial Park is making efforts and continues to make efforts to share the history of the POWs and the internment camps that were on the site. That makes this a very unique historical stop on this road trip, where you also get to explore a beautiful part of Ontario and learn something at the same time, which is pretty great. It's a two for one.
Yeah, and it's also a place where you can explore a more complex history than you otherwise might have thought you'd encounter there. Although, I mean, it's worth noting that Fort Henry, also a place with a complex history.
No, absolutely. You'll notice that there seems to be a general military theme to all of the stops today. I think that's indicative of the kinds of history that are in both Ontario and Quebec. As being the oldest parts of the country, it's kind of hard to avoid the fact that there will be a lot of colonizing and military activity in these areas.
Well, yeah, I mean, you know, we talked about how it was settlements, but that's often settlements and the military often and usually did go hand in hand because you want to, I guess, protect the people who are settling this area. You want to be able to defend it, whether it's from the locals who were already there or if it's from other people also trying to settle the area.
So keeping that in mind and continuing this theme, we are on our way and crossing the border into Quebec. To Quebec City, to be exact, and to one of Robin's favorite places.
It's true. We're going to the Plains of Abraham.
What?
A place where I was just 2 weeks ago.
On your real-life dedicated road trip.
It's true. I knew that we were doing this, so I decided that I needed to go on a road trip of my own and hit up some of these locations.
You woke up in the middle of the night. You didn't pack anything. You just jumped in the car.
Threw my child into the car.
We need to leave now.
But it's true, it worked out very well that we were able to go on a road trip of our own and that we were able to go to some of these places, and that one of those areas was, in fact, the Plains of Abraham. The Plains of Abraham are a famous and massive historical site located along the northern bank of the St. Lawrence, and they were actually named for a 17th century French fisherman, Abraham Martin.
Not only is the site historic, today it also serves as a massive park in the city. It covers 103 hectares, all of it green space in the city, in the vein of New York Central Park.
It doesn't look like Central Park, though. If you haven't been there, it's not, well, at least when I was there, it wasn't quite as verdant. It was, you know, a little, it's such a big park, and you know, they're not sprinkling it all that much, so it's not bright green grass, and as I said before, it's quite hilly. There's some rock outcroppings, there's also a citadel there, but it's very beautiful, it's very large, it's got a bunch of cool stuff. You can see the Citadel of Quebec.
So there's no Central Perk, is what you're telling me.
There's no Central Perk. However, there is the Museum of the Plains of Abraham,
oh,
which I also went to, and it was great. I really enjoyed it. They had some cool stuff there. They had the chance to actually try on different outfits for the different military units. So if you feel like going there, they've got them for adults as well as for children, and they show you just how heavy those outfits were, man. And I was there on a hot day. I would not want to be wearing like 30 extra pounds of clothing.
Sweaty. Well, it's interesting that you mentioned trying on the different military outfits, because we haven't really covered exactly why the plains or the hilly slopes of Abraham are so important. The site is most famously the location of one of the key battles in the Seven Years' War that helped significantly to shape the future of Canada. The Seven Years' War was a larger global conflict between Britain and France with their respective empires and their various European allies. The Battle of the Plains of Abraham was one of the battles that played out as part of the conflict, and it helped contribute to the eventual defeat of the French.
The battle was fought between roughly equal forces of 4,500 fighters, with Major General James Wolfe leading the British and Lieutenant General Louis-Joseph de Montcalm commanding the French. The French were entrenched in the Citadel of Quebec and had proven very difficult to dislodge.
However, Wolfe was determined to take Quebec City. But numerous efforts to antagonize Montcalm into a battle outside the Citadel failed. These efforts range from the destruction of French supplies for 65 kilometers upriver to the burning of nearby buildings. Eventually, Wolfe decided to attack directly from upriver. On September 13, 1759, the British landed 3 kilometers upriver at Lens-en-Foulon and scaled a 53-meter high cliff in the cover of darkness. This was risky, but they managed it, resulting in the army being in position on the plains at dawn.
And part of how they actually managed this very risky maneuver, I found out about at the Museum of the Plains of Abraham. And it was really interesting because they had to cross over in boats in the middle of the night under cover of darkness in order to be set up and be ready for dawn. And as they were crossing, there was actually a French scout who saw and called out into the darkness, "Who goes there?" And someone on one of these ships responded back in flawless French, "Provisions," or provisions. And so they didn't call an alarm, and the English were able to get out of the boats and overtake them and weren't at all suspected to have been there. And that was, you know, maybe that's not the entire reason that they were successful, but I'm sure that things would have been a bit different if they had found out in the night that they were coming up to, like, start this battle.
Pivotal moment. Back to the battle. Once in position, Montcalm responded quickly and chose to attack before the British were established. Many historians feel that this was actually a mistake, as he could have waited for nearby French reinforcements, and Montcalm's force was less experienced than the British.
The First Nations who fought alongside Montcalm were members of the Seven Nations, located at Lorette, Wolanac, Odenak, Kanawake, Kanetsetake, Akwesasne, and La Présentation. They made up a significant portion of the defenders of Quebec and proved to be skilled marksmen, with historians such as the Canadian War Museum's Peter MacLeod suggesting that they likely fired some of the first shots of the battle and impressed their British foes with their skill.
In the ensuing battle, the French line was crippled by a brutal opening barrage from the British. While the British won, Wolfe was killed early in the battle by several musket wounds. Montcalm was shot during the French retreat and died the following day in Quebec City. The British did not pursue the retreating French forces aggressively, allowing many to escape and continue the war for New France after the fall of Quebec City.
But I find that so sad because, you know, Wolfe, he died on the battlefield. He probably had a good idea that things were going to go his way, but Montcalm, he lived to see the defeat. He lived to see his own failure and the failure of his troops, and I just think that that's so sad. I mean, he's not the only person in history that that's happened to, certainly, but
yeah,
I feel for him.
Yeah, and it's hard to not feel connected to people when you're learning about them in history, reading about them, but I think it's especially difficult to not feel that connection when you're in a place where something happened. And I think there's a certain power to that.
And that's one of the reasons why a trip to Quebec City is such an exceptional place, and that's why we've included it on our road trip, is because you really can have this tangible connection with history. The whole city, the whole old city, at least, is really a commemoration of a couple hundred years ago and settlements and all of these different important events in Canada's history. So it's definitely worth a stop, both for your research, for your interest, and also, you know, physically stopping there if you're ever driving through. It's also worth noting that prior to the 300th anniversary of Quebec City, Sir Wilfrid Laurier championed the idea of the plains being maintained as they were, rather than being turned into a history museum. And as a result, in 1908, the Plains of Abraham, including the fields, the citadel, and other nearby parks, became the first National Historic Site in Canada. Although they do now have a museum, the Museum of the Plains of Abraham, and it's right next to the park, so you can easily get there and then walk right through, and it's very well situated. Our next and final stop on this road trip, and consequently the final stop on our entire road trip series.
I don't want the summer to end. I don't want to stop
well,
this.
Well, it doesn't mean the summer's over. It just means that our road trip is coming to an end.
It just won't be the same.
Well, at least we've picked a really good stop. It's Pointe-à-Calière in Montreal. Located on Old Montreal, not far from the city's old port, is the Pointe-à-Calière Montréal Archaeology and History Complex. This is one of Canada's only museums of archaeology and the largest museum in Montreal.
The museum resulted from a series of archaeological discoveries in the area during the 1980s. It opened in 1992 as part of the 350th anniversary celebrations that year.
Pointe-à-Calière, the location, is the exact spot where Father Vincent held mass for Paul de Chomedey de Maisonneuve, Jean Mance, and their companions on May 17, 1642. This event is recognized as the inauguration of Montreal. Later, the location gained its name when the third governor of Montreal, Louis Hector de Calière, built his home there in 1695.
The museum carries on that name and brings the historic importance of this spot to public attention. It encompasses several historic sites discovered through ongoing archaeological work in the area, from Montreal's first Catholic cemetery to the former Youville pumping station to Montreal's customs house in the 1800s. Visitors can descend into some of these parts of Old Montreal, now buried beneath the earth, such as the sewer collector, what? Sounds cool.
It does sound super cool. The site is referred to as a complex because it encompasses seven different pavilions, and as of 2017, each are connected by way of the underground path that was once the sewer collector.
Because of the variety of pavilions, the museum received national historic and archaeological status. The museum also houses thousands of artifacts found during the excavation efforts. These items are on display through the complex, alongside the visiting exhibitions.
Pointe-à-Calière also combines interesting modern architecture with that which came before. An example of this is the Éperon building, which is built on the foundations of the old Royal Insurance Company building, built in 1860 and torn down in the 1950s. The Éperon building echoes its predecessor while being a unique new structure.
I love it when they do that. When it can be done effectively.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. There is something really beautiful about that, tying in history along with like giving it new life, mm-hmm, and being able to bring in a new history into the building. I love that.
The site also makes an effort to acknowledge that Pointe-à-Calière is not entirely a location lived on exclusively by Europeans. It makes mention of the First Nations that lived on the space thousands of years before the arrival of Europeans and explores how the two cultures interacted. However, this is not the focus of the site, and I think it's important to note that.
Mm-hmm. I think it's also, you know, commendable that while it's not the focus, and they obviously have so many artifacts and different things that they're trying to showcase, it still was important that they included all of that, right? Like, mm-hmm, and I think that's really helpful. You know, it's not just, land isn't just what we thought it was as of 200 years ago or 300 years ago, or once we actually were able to find the remains on it. It's had a history long before there was a physical settlement that has left behind archaeological remains. And maybe some of those remains are no longer present, or maybe they, you know, were transient and weren't actually left there, but that doesn't mean that there isn't a longer history attached, mm-hmm, to a site.
Yeah, and I think that's been something through everywhere that we've gone today. The idea of having to select which period of time you're going to be displaying to the public and how to share those different aspects of history and time.
Mm-hmm.
And perhaps most complexly in this one, just because of the seven different pavilions and all of the different archaeological layerings, I think that's really great example of how places are starting to try to deal with that. Whether or not it is successful is up to the viewer, I think. But yeah, I don't know. I think interesting times.
Absolutely. Yeah. And I mean, it's also, it extends beyond just Ontario and Quebec, certainly. You know, we've tried to showcase a bit of that throughout our whole road trip, and especially today. And we hope that you've learned some new things, that you've been able to appreciate maybe some histories that you weren't aware of, and that this will maybe make it exciting for you to explore the history around you, whether it's close to home or on a trip that you're going to be taking.
Absolutely. You know, Robin, what I just realized?
What?
We forgot Nick at the gas station.
Oh, no.
Oh, he's never going to forgive us. He's going to be so upset. We're going to have to call his mom.
I think we left him somewhere up in the territories, didn't we?
He had a sweater. I'm sure he's fine.
I'm sure he's fine. But all that to say, Nick has been on his own road trip, and we hope that you'll be on some of your own. If you have something that you'd like to share, please mention us at Notice History. We would love to see the places that you're discovering.
Yeah, send us your pictures of your adventures and let us know how they went. Thank you for traveling with us on our virtual road trip over the last couple of weeks. You have been a delight to have in the car. Winnebago? Winnebago. Notice History is a No History podcast. We are produced by Emily Cuggy and...
myself, Robin Mullins.
This week's researchers were Nick Johnson and Mackenzie Brash, with audio mixing by Emily Cuggy. For more information about the topics we covered today, check out our blog at nohistory.ca/podcast. If you would like to get in touch with us, email us at podcast@nohistory.ca.
If you like what you hear, tell your friends and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.